In this video, we will motivate, state, and prove the inverse function theorem. So what we have is some equation of this form. F of x bar is equal to b. F is a function between two norm vector spaces, and b is an element of the codomain. So we're interested in this element of the domain. Well, intuitively, if this is true, then x bar is given by the inverse function applied to B. So what we will do now is to assume that this equation has a solution. So there is some element, x bar is equal to F inverse of B, but we'll also prove that this inverse function exists not just at the point B, but at nearby point. If you're interested in solving this equation also at nearby points, not equal to B. Here's a picture, let's zoom in on that. So there are two main cases to consider when we have a function from the real values into the real values as depicted here. First of all, let's say that B is over here on the y-axis. Well, then you see that there is just one point which corresponds to one point x bar, which has b as its function value. And if we zoom in on the graph around this point x bar, then you see that, so here is b. If we increase b a little bit, then there is still one and only one value corresponding to that, the y bar, for instance. And if we decrease b a little bit, then there is still just one and only one value corresponding to that point. So here we're using the fact, so we're using two facts basically. First of all, the derivative at this point, as you can see from the graph, is strictly positive. So that means that there is a small neighborhood around the point where the derivative is still strictly positive. Here, we're implicitly assuming that the derivative function is continuous. If you know that the continuous function is positive at one point, then it must be strictly positive at all other points in a small enough neighborhood. So that means that f is strictly increasing in this small neighborhood depicted here. And as you know from calculus, when a function is strictly positive in some interval, it's invertible in that interval. Of course, exactly the same argument would be true if the derivative was strictly negative. You would still get a strictly monotone function in an interval, and you would get, hence it would be invertible. Okay, so as long as the derivative is non-zero, and the derivative is continuous, then this works just fine. Here's the other extreme case. B is up here, and you see that that corresponds to still just one and only one value, x bar. So here's B, here's the corresponding function value, x bar. But now what happens if you increase B a little bit, there is suddenly no values corresponding to that function value. And if you were to decrease b a little bit, then there is suddenly multiple points which correspond to that function value. So this is the other extreme. The derivative at x bar is equal to zero, which is, of course, what happens here. Then the inverse function might not be well defined near the point x bar. It could attain either zero or many different values. So what we've seen so far is that for a function from the real numbers to the real numbers, for invertibility, we need the derivative at one fixed point to be non-zero, and we need a derivative to be continuous in order to get invertibility. So the continuity ensures that the derivative is also non-zero at nearby points. Well, let's see what consequences we can get from invertibility. Of course, the inverse function has to satisfy this. F of F inverse of any point is that point. Let's do some manipulation. Let's differentiate this identity on both sides. Differentiate with respect to y. The derivative of y is just 1. And here we have to use the chain rule. So we get the derivative of the outer function, f derivative, times the derivative of the inner function, the derivative of f inverse derivative. Now, if we were interested in the derivative of f inverse, then we could just solve this for this quantity and get an identity which relates the derivative of the inverse function with the derivative of f itself. So this is a special case of a general technique called implicit differentiation. And here you see very clearly that the derivative has to be non-zero, otherwise this wouldn't make sense. So the derivative of f must be non-zero at the point x bar and at nearby points. Well, if the derivative is non-zero at this point and the derivative is continuous at the point x bar, then this is guaranteed to be non-zero at nearby points also. So here we see explicitly when trying to differentiate the inverse function that these two conditions come up again. Let's try to do precisely this computation again, but for vector valued functions. Say we have a function from one norm vector space to another. Let's assume for the moment that it has an inverse going the other way. Well, again, an inverse has to satisfy this for all points y. Well, this is the same as saying that the identity, the function that takes y and gives you y, must be equal to the composition of f and n, f inverse. Okay, let's now differentiate. Now at this point, we've learned some calculus with Fréchet derivatives. So we know how to differentiate the identity operator. The identity operator is a linear operator, and the Fréchet derivative of a linear operator is the linear operator itself. So the derivative of the identity is the identity. Here we have, on the right-hand side, we have a composition of two functions, and then we have to use the chain rule for Fréchet derivatives. We get the derivative of the outermost function, derivative, of composed with the derivative of the innermost function. So it's of f inverse derivative at the point y that we're looking at. So now, if we're interested in the derivative of the inverse function, then that appears here. So what we have to do is to apply the inverse of all of this. Well, this is a bounded linear operator, and hopefully it's invertible. Well, if it's invertible, then we can apply the inverse of this bounded linear operator on both sides. So we get that the argument, which is all that's left on this side, so that's this, is equal to the inverse of this applied to the identity operator. So that doesn't do anything. So the derivative of the inverse is the inverse of the derivative. So all of this means that the Fréchet derivative, f derivative, that's this one, must be continuous, and its derivative at the point x bar must be invertible. So if what's inside here is invertible, then this makes sense. And we can indeed differentiate the inverse function. So this is the correct generalization of this statement and these two conditions, that the Fréchet derivative must be continuous at the point x bar, and the derivative at the point x bar must be invertible. As we'll see, we can conclude exactly the same, or the same analogous statement as before, that the derivative must also be invertible at nearby points so that this actually makes sense. Okay, so first, before I state the inverse function theorem, let's just recall what invertible for a bounded linear operator mean. It means the obvious thing, that the bounded linear operator should be bijective, and next, the inverse should itself be a bounded linear operator. We'll see that being a bounded linear operator is essential for our theorem to work out. Next, I've also been talking about continuity of the derivative. Well, this is a Fréchet derivative. So what do we mean by continuity of that? Well, that means continuity with respect to the operator norm. So if you fix a point X bar and X approaches X bar, then the derivative should approach the derivative at X bar in the operator norm. So this is what we'll assume next. And here comes the inverse function theorem. We start with two norm vector spaces, and we'll have to make the assumption that the first norm vector space is complete. We'll see where that comes in. Let's say we have some open subset of the domain X and a function from the open domain into Y. This function is assumed to be Fréchet differentiable at every point. And then at some fixed point, X bar, this is some point where F derivative is continuous and the derivative is an invertible bounded linear operator. So this is analogous to saying that in the real value case, F derivative at X bar is non-zero. The theorem then says that there is some small neighborhood, let's call it U, of X bar. There is some corresponding neighborhood V of F of X bar, such that F, when only looking as a function between U and V, it's bijective, and its inverse function is Fréchet differentiable at every single point in the codomain of F, in other words, the domain of F inverse. And the derivative of the inverse is the inverse of the derivative. Here's a picture. So you have this space, this open set O lying in X. You have a point X bar, which is mapped to the point F of X bar in the vector space Y. All that X is complete. The statement of the theorem is that there is some small neighborhood U of X bar, so that every single point here can be mapped directed to V, and vice versa. If you have a point V, then there is an inverse mapping taking you back again to the corresponding point. So this point is mapped here by F and is mapped back again by F inverse. Okay, this will be the longest proof of this course. So I'll break it down into six main steps. The first step is a simplification of our situation. We'll replace F by a different function. We'll later call it G, but let's call it just F for now. We'll do what is called a normalization so that the derivative at the point X bar is particularly simple. It's the identity operator. Well, in particular, we will then get that if you insert the definition of Fréchet differentiability of F at the point X bar, then that looks like this. Sigma is the function F of X minus F of X bar minus the derivative, which is just the identity of X minus X bar. So the sigma function becomes particularly simple under this simplification. The next step is to use Banach's lemma to prove that not only is F derivative at X bar invertible, but F derivative at X is invertible for all points X close to X bar. If you've forgotten Banach's lemma, then you should go back to section 5.5 now. Pause the video and go back to section 5.5 to see what Banach's lemma says. Third, let's say we have a point y in the codomain. What we're interested in finding a point x mapping to that point. We want to find the inverse mapping. We want to find some x so that f of x is equal to y. And when we've found some point x satisfying that and y is arbitrary, then we've found the inverse mapping. Well, how can we reformulate this in a form that's simpler to use? Let's add and subtract lots of terms on both sides here. We can rewrite this as this. Remember that sigma is defined up here. You should pause the video now, insert the value for sigma of x and check that this is actually precisely the same as this. Once you've done that, let's give all of this a name. Let's call it h of x. So what we're after is a point x satisfying this equation. X is equal to h of x. So we want to find a fixed point for h. Once we found that, we know for sure that this equation is satisfied, which is what we're after. So now we start focusing on this function h. We will prove that this function h is a contraction for points x close to x bar. When we have a contraction from a complete metric space to another, then we can apply Banach's fixed point theorem to find the fixed point. The fixed point will be unique and it will exist. So we will have found our fixed point satisfying this, in other words, satisfying this, which is what we want. And the final step is this statement about differentiability of the inverse function. And we'll compute its derivative. So those are the six main steps of this proof. Okay, let's start with step number one. We'll call this new function, this normalized function, as g. So g of x will be the inverse of the derivative at x bar. Remember that we've assumed that this exists, f derivative at x bar is invertible, applied to the function value f of x. Well, this is the same as saying if you apply just f derivative on both sides, then this will cancel. So what's left on the right-hand side, f of x is equal to f derivative of x bar applied to g of x. Okay, so this and this is precisely the same. Now, instead of getting a function f from x to y, we have gotten a function g from x, this lies in x, this lies in y, and this is a mapping from y to x. So all of this actually lies in x. So g is a function between x and x. So in this way, we've first of all gotten rid of this y space completely. And second, this normalization brings with it some simplifications. Let's see what properties G has. Well, G is differentiable because it's the composition of a linear operator, which is also always differentiable, and a function which is differentiable. We can compute its derivative by applying the chain rule. It's the derivative of the bounded linear operator, which is the bounded linear operator itself, composed with the derivative of the what's inside here. So yeah, we get this. In particular, g derivative is continuous at x bar because this is continuous and this is continuous at x bar. Moreover, so f derivative is invertible. So in particular, if you insert x equals x bar, you get f derivative of x bar inverse composed with f derivative of x bar. So those cancel and you get identity. So the derivative at x bar is particularly simple. So note now that all of the properties that we assumed about f are also hold for the function g. It's differentiable everywhere. G derivative is continuous at x bar, and the derivative at x bar is invertible. Actually, it's particularly simple. So now we can prove what we wanted for the g function instead, and then transform that to properties of f. So our goal will be to prove that g is bijective in some neighborhood, which we'll call u of x bar, and that we'll prove this statement here. The inverse of this particular value, where y bar is f of x bar, is equal to the identity. Well, what does that imply? We claim that this means that f is bijective. Well, f is given up here. This thing is invertible, and now this is bijective. So that means that f is also invertible with this inverse function. Moreover, the derivative at y bar is equal to, now you can insert here, you can differentiate this and you get this long expression. But after using this property, you get just f derivative at y bar, which is what we wanted. And at that point, we're done. So this is not now what we will prove. All right, here comes step two. G derivative is continuous at the point x bar. So here is x bar. That means that there is some radius r prime bigger than zero, such that if you pick point x closer to x bar than r prime, then the distance between g derivative at those points and g derivative at x bar is not too big. Let's say smaller than 1/2. This is continuity. Continuity means that you, by making the input values close to one another, you can make the function values close to one another. Well, g derivative at x bar, that's particularly simple. That's the identity. We can now apply Banach's lemma, which says that essentially, if you're close enough to an invertible bounded linear operator, then that thing is itself invertible. So Banach's lemma, so go to section 5.5 and look it up, then implies that this bounded linear operator is also an invertible bounded linear operator, no matter which point x you pick in this open set. Moreover, Banach's lemma gives you a bound on how big the inverse of this bounded linear operator can be. It says that it's at most 1 divided by 1 minus this number. Well, this number is at most 1/2, and there's a minus sitting here. So if you insert that bigger number, you get something even bigger. 1 over 1 minus 1/2 is 2. Okay, so we found that g derivative is invertible in some neighborhood of x bar, and we've found an upper bound on how big the size of this derivative is. Okay, here's the next step. Let's fix some point y in the codomain of g, which is x. What we're after is to find the inverse image of that point. In other words, we want to find some point x satisfying g of x is equal to y. This is what we're after. Let's define the function sigma of x, which is g of x minus g of x bar, minus the derivative of g at x bar of x minus x bar. Now, this is particularly simple. It's the identity. So this is what you get when you insert that. Remember from the definition of Fréchet differentiability of g at x bar, that this goes to zero as x approaches x bar. So let's assume for the moment that we have been able to find a point x satisfying g of x is y. Y, remember, is some fixed value. Well, then sigma is g of x, which is y, minus this other stuff. Well, let's now put x on this side and sigma on this side. What you get is that x is left on the left-hand side, and the on the right-hand side, you get something which we'll call h, which is everything that's left on the right-hand side now. So what we're actually after is a fixed point for this new function h. If we found a fixed point, then that's the same as saying that x is equal to h of x, which is the same as saying that g of x is equal to y, which we're after. So we want to prove that no matter which point y we pick, there is a unique fixed point for this new function h. That's step number four. Now, this is true, remember? So that means that if x and x bar are close enough, we can make this ratio as small as we want. Let's say less than half. So let's pick a point r double prime positive, so that as long as the distance between x and x bar is less than or equal to r double prime, this ratio is less than half, which is the same as saying this. Now we have two radii, so let's just let r be the smallest of those two. And now we have a candidate for our set u. It's not precisely our set u, so we'll call it u tilde. U tilde is the closed ball with radius r, where r is the minimum of this one and r prime. What we claim now is that there's two things which we'll need for Banach's fixed point theorem. The first one is that h is actually a function from u tilde to u tilde. It doesn't take us outside of u tilde. Next, h is a contraction on u tilde. Let's prove those two things. Let's pick a point x in u tilde. Well, we want to prove that h of x lies in the set u tilde. What does it mean to lie there? It's the same as saying that the distance between h of x and x tilde is at most r. X bar is at most r. So that's what we want to prove. We want to estimate this distance. If you insert now h of x and subtract x bar, you will get this stuff. And let's apply the triangle inequality here. The norm of this is at most the norm of this plus the norm of sigma. Well, the norm of sigma, we have a bound on. It's this one. So this first term, we can bound by the norm of x minus x bar divided by 2. And now the second part, or the first term, we don't have a bound on. Because if you go back now and see where y's first entered, y was an arbitrary point. We want this to be small. Want this term to be small. So here we see that y cannot be an arbitrary point. Y has to be picked sufficiently close to this value. So let's assume that it has been, and let's then see what consequences it has. Let's assume that y was chosen initially so that this is less than r divided by 2. So here we're assuming that the norm of y minus g of x bar is less than half of r. Okay, we just have to keep this in mind. What we get is this. Well, how big can the second term be? X was picked to be lie in u tilde. U tilde is this ball. So that means that this term is at most r. It's this, so you get r half plus r half is r. So we have proven that under this condition, we are guaranteed that h of x lies in this closed ball. So we have this condition now. Right? And actually this set, the set of all points y satisfying this, that's this open ball here, this will be our V space mentioned earlier. So that proves the first claim. Let's prove also that H is a contraction on the set U tilde. Well, what we can do is to compute the size of the derivative of h. The derivative is a bounded linear operator, so the size is measured in the operator norm. If you go back to the definition of h and differentiate it, then you'll see that it's simply the derivative of sigma. The derivative of sigma is g of x minus g of x bar. Now, this is something we have a bound on. Let's go back a little bit. We pick this first radius so that precisely this is less than 1/2. So, and our point r is even smaller than this r prime. So we're guaranteed that this is satisfied. So we have a bound on the derivative. It's at most 1/2. At this point, we can apply the mean value theorem. That's section 6.3. You should pause now and look up section 6.3 if you don't remember this. The mean value theorem for vector value function says that if the derivative of the bounded linear operator is at most 1/2 in this case, then h is Lipschitz continuous with Lipschitz constant 1/2. Well, being Lipschitz continuous with any constant which is strictly less than 1 is the same as saying that it's a contraction. The contraction constant will be 1/2. So we have proven both of our claims. We can now go to step number 5. Our set U tilde, which was P, the closure of the set, it's a closed ball, radius x bar, center r. It's a closed subset of x, which is a complete space. So U tilde itself is a complete metric space. Closed subset of a complete metric space is complete. So this means that all of the ingredients which are required for Banach's fixed point theorem are in place. Banach's fixed point theorem now implies that there exists a unique, so existence symbol with exclamation mark is read as there exists a unique. There exists a unique point x in U tilde satisfying x is equal to h of x. That's a fixed point. Well, if you go back to the definition of h now, you'll see that satisfying this is exactly the same as satisfying this. G of x is equal to y. So to summarize, for every point y in the set V, we've found the existence of a unique point x in U tilde satisfying G of x is equal to y. So in other words, for every point y in the set V, we've been able to go back again to a point x satisfying f of x is equal to that point y, sorry, g of x. So this point is unique. We can give it a name which only depends on y. Let's call it g inverse of y. The selection of this point x only depends on the choice of y. So we can give it a name which relates to y. Well, we can apply this for any point y. So this defines a function, G inverse. It goes from the set V into actually a subset of U tilde. So we have now found that there exists a function G inverse, or we give it this name, going from V to U, with a defining property that G of this object G inverse, that's what we called Gx earlier, is equal to the point Y. So G of G inverse of Y is equal to Y. In other words, this function is an inverse of G. And finally, so as I said, V is mapped into a subset of U tilde. It's not the entire set U tilde. So let's just say that U now is the inverse map of this entire set V. So it's G inverse applied to V. This is a subset of U tilde. So to summarize now, this new set U, which might be this set, is a neighborhood of X bar. It's an open set containing X bar. And V is a neighborhood of G of X bar. Remember that V was defined to be an open ball centered at G of X bar. The function G from U to V is bijective. Picking a point here, and applying F to it, you land up in V. If you apply G. If you apply G inverse, you go back again to an element of U. Right. Now we're ready for our final step. What I claim is that this inverse function is also differentiable, and its derivative is the inverse of the derivative of G. From step two, we know that G derivative is invertible for every point X in the set U. We also got a bound, which was given to us by Banach's lemma. The size of the inverse of the derivative, this bounded linear operator, is at most 2. Moreover, G is invertible at every point X in U. So if you define this function now, this is the expression appearing in the definition of Fréchet differentiability, then this expression goes to 0 as the input value Z goes to X. So this is a restatement of the fact that G is Fréchet differentiable at every point X in U, not just X bar. So since this fraction goes to 0 as Z approaches X, that means that if we let Z be close enough to X, let's say a distance at most delta, we can make this fraction less than, let's say, a fourth. So let's do that. For some fixed point X in U, let's fix a number delta so that as long as Z is close enough, closer to X than delta, then this fraction is at most 1/4. So this is now what we have. Sigma is defined here. Let's compute this, X minus Z. Well, X minus Z appears here, only with the opposite sign. But what's outside of here, this is a bounded linear operator, which is invertible, remember? So you can apply the inverse of this bounded linear operator on both sides and get just X minus Z or Z minus X. So if you solve this for Z minus X, then you get this expression. Let's compute the norm of X minus Z now. Well, we know that this is a bounded linear operator of something. When you take the norm of that, that's at most the operator norm of that bounded linear operator times the norm of this. Let's apply the triangle inequality to this. So you get the norm of the first thing plus the norm of the second. Everything is multiplied by the norm of this bounded linear operator. Well, the size of this, remember from the previous page, is at most 2. So we can insert the upper bound 2 here. And the size of this term is at most a fourth of the size of X minus Z. And here we don't do anything. Okay, so what you have now is that the size of X minus Z is at most 2 times a fourth, that's 1/2, times the same number. The number is at most half of the same number plus something else. Well, if you move this on the left-hand side now, so half will cancel with half. So if you multiply by 2 on both sides, you will get this. Okay, this will be useful to us. Let's now pick a point Y in V. Let's set X to be the inverse map of that. And let, for this number Z here, let Y tilde be G of Z. So what this means is that, so we have fixed y and z now, the corresponding points x and we have, let's see, we have fixed y and y tilde, we have corresponding points x and z. So another way of stating this is that the norm of x minus z is at most 4 times, well, g of x, that's y. Let's see, g of x, that's y, so that's this one. G of z, that's y tilde, so that's this one. Okay, so this gives us a relation between points in the domain of g and the codomain of g. So this means that all of this is what we want to bound in the definition of Fréchet differentiability of G inverse. Well, this is equal to, so let's see. Where does this come from? Well, this comes from here, really. So let's see, x minus z, that's x, or this is x actually. Here is z, that's g inverse of y tilde. Here is the inverse operator at this point. Here is sigma, that's there. And this is y minus y tilde, so that's there. So this is just a restatement of this after applying these mappings. So that means that if you take the norm of this, that's as most equal to the operator norm of this, which is 2, times the norm of sigma, the sigma function. So that's this. Okay, this is a lot at once. So these are the things that we've found so far. So this is what we want to say goes to 0 in order to deduce Fréchet differentiability of G inverse. Here's our candidate for the Fréchet derivative. Well, what we found now is that the numerator is at most 2 times the sigma function. The denominator, we can bound from below. Here is this term. So if we divide by 4 on both sides, we have an upper bound on the denominator. If you insert an upper bound, if you insert a lower bound on the denominator, then you get an upper bound. So you get something even bigger. It's a 4th times this. So all in all, you get 2 divided by a 4th is 8 times sigma divided by x minus z. Well, now, if we let y tilde converge to y, then that means that z converges to x. If z converges to x, then this fraction goes to 0 by the Fréchet differentiability of G. So all in all, this goes to 0. This proves that G inverse is indeed differentiable, and that the derivative of the inverse function is the inverse of the derivative of the original function. This finishes the proof. So if you have any questions or comments, please don't hesitate to get in touch.